The Sky is Busy by Pat Christie. I saw my first feather falling from the sky yesterday, separated from a bird's body flying somewhere. But it was how it gently spiraled to Mother Earth, and then it landed on the concrete, like it had been part of the scenery forever. How could such beauty, gentleness, and serenity be a part of this fast, honking, concrete earth jungle? The feather reminded me of a story a man once told me about his son watching an eagle's feather float from the sky until he caught it between the tips of his fingers. I saw, but I didn't catch the glory of this moment.
This week marks Aboriginal Awareness Week in Canada. It's a period set aside by the federal government to honor the diverse cultures and traditions of the Métis, Inuit, and First Nations people. I want to reflect today on the beauty of the Aboriginal worldview, culture, and traditions. Given that Unitarian Universalism is a pluralistic faith committed to inclusion, diversity, and multiculturalism, and that we draw from multiple sources and sacred texts, I think we also need to figure out how we can be more intentionally respectful in borrowing from other cultures. I want to get us thinking and talking about how non-Aboriginal Canadians can strengthen and heal relationships with Canada's First Peoples and continue the process of reconciliation. First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people have extremely diverse cultures that are connected to their particular regions and their own group's history. The sacred rituals of Aboriginal people reflect an understanding of the universe in which their own origins are explained through various creation stories, one we heard a little bit earlier. The first book of the Hebrew Bible offers another version of a creation story. Genesis is not a historical or scientific text, but rather a mixture of myths and legends, cultural memories, reshaped traditions, and literary excellence. It begins with a story about the origins of the cosmos, humankind, and the people of Israel. So it goes, God creates the cosmos, first the light, and God saw that it was good, and then God divided the heavens and the earth, the seas from the land, morning from evening, and God saw that it was good. God creates the vegetation, the animals, and finally humans, and tells them all to multiply, and then God surveys his handiwork and concludes that it was very good. Well, I find it curious that the creation of the interdependent web of all existence in 6 days, no less, is assessed as merely good, with no reference to its beauty. In our story for all ages, right after Glooskap acknowledges the seven directions, which entail himself and the whole cosmos, he asks the Creator what his purpose in life is. Remember the reply? The Creator says, "You are going to meet someone." And this speaks to the relational aspect of our lives, which bring us into contact with different worldviews, other cultures, wisdom, and experiences. And I think this is where beauty comes into play. Beauty is such a subjective concept. So is beauty about unity and erotic love, as Plato suggested? Or about longing and desire, as the Romantics wrote? Or might we agree with David Hume, who said that beauty is pleasure and satisfaction to the soul? I lean towards Hume's notion Contemporary writers remind us to consider the interactive aspect of beauty. Alice Walker says, whenever you are creating beauty around you, you are restoring your own soul. And poet Mary Oliver writes, we need beauty because it makes us ache to be worthy of it. So beauty becomes defined through purpose and interaction. Earlier this week, I was in Edmonton attending a course for my doctoral program. And I stayed in the home of a lovely Unitarian couple who generously hosted Camilla and I for 10 days. So picture this. I am sitting on the rooftop deck of a large multi-million dollar property in one of Edmonton's most affluent neighborhoods. The sun is shining and I revel in my surroundings, clean, quiet, peaceful, orderly, opulent, and the greenery is lush. Even the neighborhood dogs seem to be of a certain pedigree. So while this all strikes me as beautiful, I'm also troubled a bit and become increasingly uncomfortable as an unsettling dichotomy comes to mind. You see, a few miles away is the inner city neighborhood where I lived for 2 years, a place where day-to-day life is very different. In the mansions surrounding me, there are no single mothers who have to work 3 minimum wage jobs to care for their kids. It is safe, comfortable here, and frankly, a bit boring. The only diversity in this wealthy enclave is seen in people hired to mow the lawns for landscaping companies. I loved living in the inner city. It was a little gritty by times, but oh so real. My ground level apartment in public housing bordered an alley. And this building sat by the LRT tracks and faced sheds covered in graffiti art. The alley was a corridor for stray animals and lost humans, all characters with fascinating stories. My neighbors included a pair of freelance sex trade workers, a 17-year-old drug dealer, and 2 women who often got into paintball warfare over minor disagreements. Nearby were some small, weathered, wooden houses, many occupied by extended Aboriginal families. And I was fortunate to learn a lot about urban Aboriginal culture while living and working in Edmonton. I also learned that beauty is fully relational. Me in relation to other people, me in relation to the living natural world, others in relation to other beings. Beauty is, I think, tied to our emotional response to something, to the sort of experience from whence we from our depths. Knowing that in that moment we occupy a unique point in time and space, our witness to the experience feels like a gift. My own cultural roots in Quebec are a mix of Mohawk, Abenaki, and of European colonials. My Métis heritage was long overshadowed, unnamed, perhaps because of my family's shame and discomfort around claiming it. My head and heart now lie in both traditions, both cultures, and both heritages. The European ancestral heritage, which participated in the oppression of the first people of Canada so they could build lives in a new land, and my Aboriginal ancestors who experienced that oppression but left me with influences of a culture tied to the land and committed to the family and community. Well, there must have been harmony at some point, at least long enough for the birth of Métis babies. My grandmother my uncle and cousins were all central to my upbringing and developing my worldview. In the 3 years I lived in Edmonton, I learned more about Aboriginal culture and history, and I also allowed the pain, sadness, and shame of our nation's history to wash over me. For 120 years, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were sent to some 130 Indian residential schools across this country, funded by the federal government and run by the churches. The last school closed, when do you think? 1996. So during this residential school era, 150,000 Aboriginal children were taken from their families. And communities in order to be stripped of their language, cultural identity, and traditions. Canada's attempt to wipe out Aboriginal cultures failed, but it left an urgent need for reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. The ongoing impact of the residential schools era has been felt throughout generations and has contributed to social problems that persist today. Aboriginal people face constant marginalization and discrimination. Studies show individuals who are Aboriginal receive inferior health care services because of systemic racism and enduring stereotypes. Aboriginal men and women make up a disproportionate percentage of people who are incarcerated in our prisons, many of them unjustly. In 2008, Prime Minister Harper, on behalf of the Canadian government, delivered a formal apology to former students, their families, and communities for Canada's role in the operation of these residential schools. With the support of the Assembly of First Nations and Inuit organizations, former residential school students took the federal government and the churches to court. Their cases led to the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement, the largest class action settlement in Canadian history. The government released compensation money to survivors, generous amounts, some would say, yet if we consider the economic gains made off of Aboriginal lands for oil and mining purposes, and the irreparable damage done to the land and water supplies, the loss of hunting and fishing grounds, the loss of a way of life, it seems hardly anything. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was then established to begin repairing the harm caused by residential schools, and that harm runs deep. The Commission's mandate these last 7 years has been to learn the truth about what happened in those residential schools and to inform Canadians about this reality. It has provided former students and anyone affected by the Indian residential school legacy with an opportunity to share their individual experiences in a safe and culturally appropriate manner. Many tears were shed at the public events held by the Commission, shed by people who bravely shared their stories, and by those who listened, like me. Stories of physical, sexual, and sexual abuse emerged. Brave accounts of beatings for speaking one's native language. Description of deprivation, even of drug experimentation on some children. Some spoke of untreated illnesses and certainly missing the foods they had known all their lives. Others mourned the unrecorded burials of children who lie in hidden graves. There was punishment for practicing familiar ways, hair and clothing stripped away. Many lamented they were taken away, in some cases without parental knowledge. Acres of tissues were collected and then burned ceremoniously in the sacred fire at each Truth and Reconciliation Commission gathering site. So the Commission has been gathering records and taking testimonies from church officials who operated the schools and recording these experiences of survivors, their families, communities, and those personally affected by the residential school experience and its subsequent generational impacts. Canadian history is being rewritten, this time with accuracy. I attended two of these Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings in Alberta, one in Muscatchees, a community of four Cree Nation reserves, and the other a four-day national event held in Edmonton last May. And that experience changed me. The stories I heard made me aware of the centrality of culture for Aboriginal people. I became aware that injustice, love, and truth are only meaningful when humility, honesty, and forgiveness are equally offered. So a year ago, I stood in a big convention hall with thousands of other people. I wore this canary yellow t-shirt proudly, and I listened to Reverend Meg Riley and Gary Groot of the CUC deliver a public statement on behalf of the Canadian Unitarian Council and the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada. Here's a little bit of what they said that day. We commit to the journey of healing and reconciliation between Canadian Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. We commit to these steps to advance that journey. To assemble educational materials for our congregations. Regarding the history and impact of the Indian residential school system. To commit a new program for congregations about racial equity and intercultural competency, and to commit to encourage our congregations to learn more about the richness of Aboriginal spirituality and cultures, working together to advance the struggle for justice for Aboriginal people. The whole document can be found on the CUC website. Coincidentally, the closing week of this truth and reconciliation process will take place in Ottawa in 2 weeks' time. Aboriginal spirituality speaks of walking in beauty, beauty behind us, before us, beneath us, and within us, the seven directions. There is beauty in the Aboriginal worldview, a worldview that shapes a response to life that offers reliable direction toward answering the human quest for life meaning and purpose. I'd just like to highlight some of the characteristics unique to the Aboriginal worldview, a relational, circular way of relating stories, knowledge acquired through daily experiences, the senses and intuition that comes through interrelation with all creation, not to mention the validity of dreams and visions as sources of wisdom. Strong family and community relationships, egalitarianism and inclusiveness, a close spiritual connection to the land, seeing equal validity in different points of view, history and collective experience giving context to each person's experience. Aboriginal people value slow relationship building. Language is built on metaphor and use of symbol. Oh, the English language might use words that define, for example, speaking of that bad boy, whereas an Aboriginal language would refer to the boy who did bad things. The Aboriginal worldview values intergenerational relationships and is open to lifelong analysis and interpretation by elders. It uses storytelling and talking circles as an important means of communicating. And it respects the cultural importance of ceremonies and ritual, like smudging, sweat lodge, sacred fires, and so on. Marjorie Bowens Wheatley is an African-American Unitarian Universalist minister who wrote an impressive essay entitled Cornrows, Kwanzaa, and Confusion, The Dilemma of Cultural Racism and Misappropriation. She says in part this, "There's probably no such thing as a pure religion or a pure culture. To some extent, we all appropriate culture. And since time immemorial, religions have borrowed from each other. Cultural appropriation can be defined, for one, as a form of racial or religious prejudice, or in the most general terms, as a form of plagiarism. It is about incorporating language, cultural expressions, forms, lifestyles, rituals, or practices about which there is little basis for direct knowledge, experience, or authenticity into one's being. It is also the superficial appreciation of a culture without regards to its deeper meaning. And finally, cultural appropriation is acting in ways that belie understanding or respect the historical, social, and spiritual context out of which particular traditions and cultural expressions were born. Many who practice cross-cultural borrowing have completely honorable intentions, though Bowens Wheatley cautions that naivete seems to characterize the actions of many people who find themselves in that delicate place relative to intercultural relations. As Unitarian Universalists, we are unique in our approach to embracing other religions in worship, programming, and religious education. We intentionally seek to learn about world religions and share other cultural rituals and traditions. Unfortunately, we lack depth in our understanding of the historical, racial, cultural, and religious context, as well as sensitivity to these contexts, says Bowens Wheatley. At worst, our approach is assimilation, a combination of voyeurism and thievery, which in effect seems to say, from the distance of time and space, we have permission to take a myopic view, look at whatever culture we choose, and to beg, borrow, and steal whatever we like, and make it our own. But what if we begin by actively acknowledging that cultural formations and traditions come from the organic experience of a people and are sacred, and that many religious and cultural traditions have been historically violated? Unitarian Universalists can embrace and participate in different cultural or religious traditions, but maybe we need to think more deeply about how to embrace other traditions, how to honor and respect the cultural and religious context out of which they were born and continue to live. Matt Myers is a musician, and he suggests these screening questions. Does this culture want its music, text, or ritual presented in diverse contexts? What is the history of my relationship and my culture group's relationship with this other group? Did we benefit from past or current exploitation of this group? Do we fully understand the original context of this music or ritual or text, and how much of that understanding and context will be conveyed to our audience? By changing the time, place, speakers or performers, and other contexts of this music, text, or ritual, how is the original meaning changed? Reconciliation is a religious task, but it has a political dimension. It requires moving beyond first steps to completely dismantle the institutional and cultural practices that have sustained the power of one group over another in determining cultural norms, equal opportunity, equitable laws, and policies of governance. That is a tall order, and the journey awaits. Hi, hi, Jean McWitch, and blessed be. This is a short music video by a Métis group of women from mostly from the West Coast and some from Alberta, called Ma Girl, M'Girl. And the piece is called Eyes Wide Open.
Go stunning.